So we'll be talking a little bit more about the context of the participants, but it's important to point out that I'm doing this research in conjunction with a member of the community, so Kim Stoker is an insider, and she'll be talking a little bit about the work that she's done in South Korea. Okay, and while this is perhaps a very specific and very unique context for research, we feel that this is not limited to kind of a peculiar set of people with very peculiar like circumstances, because we think that this issue of how heritage languages offer dislocated and relocated people spaces to belong, opportunities to find spaces to belong, it's really linked to notions of settlement success, which is also relevant for migrants of all kinds, social recognition in the United States and places like South Korea, and of course the sense of ethnic and cultural belonging is often strongly tied to heritage language learning. And we also see that this is a very 21st century kind of phenomenon that we think will only expand. So there are the examples of the Korean pierogi families, some of you may know about, where the families sort of split up and the father stays in South Korea to earn a living and sends his children and his wife usually to the United States for English education. And this leads to tensions regarding social recognition, social exclusion, language loss, and cultural identity. There are lots of other examples. I think the Kikokushijo examples, the returnees to Japan, are very similar, experiencing sort of a tension of cultural and ethnic belonging both in places like North America and then back in Japan as returnees. And specific to our topic, there are going to be lots of future adoptee returnees given the rate of international adoption. So Korea is sort of the most substantial example, having a long history of international adoption, and this is really only on the increase. Of course, immigrants who shuttle back and forth, we think this is also relevant too. So, we're also framing our work in heritage language studies, of course, and we feel that there's a tendency to assume that heritage language learners are able to find spaces for belonging once they've acquired the heritage language. And there's also kind of a tendency to assume that heritage languages are closely tied to ethnic identity, and that's why people study them. And this we can see in Cho's quote here from her work on Korean heritage language learning in the United States, who says that, those who have developed their heritage language have greater understanding and knowledge of cultural values, ethics, and manners. This further enhances their interactions with heritage language speakers. So this idea that social inclusion automatically results from heritage language learning is a strong assumption in a lot of the literature. And this is something that we don't necessarily see in the Korean adoptee community who lives in Seoul and who has made many efforts to learn Korean as a heritage language. So this is the neglected context that we're going to be looking at. And in fact, there was a recent publication in the Heritage Language Journal on Korean heritage language learning, which excludes this context. So we'd like to add this context to this list of published research. And our research question is, does Korean heritage language learning provide Korean adoptee returnees, K-80s, with a sense of belonging? And how might we see this? How might we study this? Our approach is going to be narrative analysis, and we're very interested in this for lots of reasons, including identity construction, but we think it has practical implications for the teaching and learning of heritage languages, the conception of heritage in language learning, and then, of course, the methodology, the discourse analysis of narrative analysis. Okay, so turning to the context.
So I'll just give a very brief overview on the history of international adoption out of Korea. International adoption out of Korea is a byproduct of the Korean War, which was from 1950 to 1953. It's actually not officially finished as of today. It's in truce. And so since approximately 1953, approximately 200,000 children have been sent from South Korea to over 15 different Western countries. Now, the South Korean model, or South Korea is considered sort of the model of international adoption. The phenomenon that we see today of international or transracial adoption really started in South Korea. And what started off as a humanitarian war effort to place war orphans and children of mixed race developed in the 70s and the 80s into a full-scale industry. And so the system in South Korea, again, it's considered sort of the model nation that other nations, including Russia, Ethiopia, Guatemala, China, model their adoption programs after. The South Korean program is considered to be the children are easily assimilated, children are from generally of good health, and the system in Korea is considered to be legitimate. There's not a lot of child trafficking going on. Yeah, and then, so we've been looking at the KAD community in South Korea, and starting in around 1995, the mid-90s, KAD started returning to Korea in large numbers, and it started increasing in the late 1990s, and continues, and the numbers continue to increase. Right now, there's approximately 200 returnees living in Korea. And this is, again, from not just North America and Australia, but from many European nations as well. And additionally, an interesting thing that has happened since the late 90s and the early 2000s is there are three adoptee activist organizations that are adoptee run only. One is a sort of post-adoption service organization, and two are adoptee activist organizations whose primary goal is not only advocacy for the adoptee community, but also looking at international adoption from a critical perspective, with the aim of encouraging the Korean government to end international adoption out of Korea. So, including myself, who I conducted the interviews, there were three other participants, I've been living in Korea on and off for about 11 years. And I was adopted to the United States as an infant, less than a year old. And I studied Korean studies in graduate school, and I have studied Korean language in a program in graduate school and as well at a university in South Korea. And then of our first informant, Kelly, she's a filmmaker, and she's also an English language tutor. And she was adopted to the United States with a twin sister at about 8.5 years old. And she's been living in Korea for approximately 8 years. And she's also studied in Korean language programs on and off. And she doesn't consider her Korean to be fluent by any means, even though she's lived in Korea for a long period of time. And she started off as a Korean speaker for the first 8.5 years of her life. And the next person is Lori. She's in her mid-20s. She's a student, and she's an English tutor. That's how she makes her living in South Korea. That's how a lot of the native, the English speakers make their living. She's lived in Korea for approximately 2.5 years, and she recently completed a full Korean language program, which it's a 6-level program at a university in Korea. And she was adopted at the age of about 4.5, also with a sister, a twin sister. And then the third person, Anne, she's in her mid to late 30s, and she's an editor. She edits for one of the news agencies in South Korea. She's also a writer who's published 2 memoirs on her experience in Korea. And she was adopted to the United States, to Minnesota, when she was an infant. And she studied Korean language in a couple of different programs on and off. And she also doesn't consider her Korean to be fluent.
So Kim is an analyst here, but she's also very much a member of this community. And we'll see that some of her narratives are also data. So this kind of research, I feel, is very, I'm obligated to not work on my own, but rather to collaborate with insiders. And we couldn't have gotten this rich data without Kim's participation. So the method was these face-to-face interviews, and Kim carried them out with the three women. Actually, there's a larger corpus than that. This is the basis for today's talk. And we're drawing on Michael Bamberg's framework for narrative analysis, and a very specific part of it, looking at how the shifts in the interviews between the storytelling world, the here and now of the interviewee, interviewer, and the shifts to the story world, where there's recounting of past events, right? So Looking at those shifts as moments where evaluative language can show us the positioning of participants. So Mike Weber has talked a lot about, written a lot about this notion of positioning, and that's what we're looking at with these interviews. Okay, so kind of a starting point for looking at the data is to look for what kind of spaces the women talk about in the interviews that are given to them by Koreans. And this seems to be kind of a starting point across all of the interviews as well. How are you received by Koreans? And there's a whole litany of labels, you know, Korean, real Korean, these kinds of ways of referring to the Korean nationals as separate and different from the Korean adoptees. And Kelly, for example, talks a lot about this expectation that just looking Korean, being of Korean descent, having a Korean face, raises all kinds of interesting expectations about the genetic link between language ability and her own ability and her actual ability. And for her, it's particularly painful since she lost her language at the age of 8 in the United States. Lori similarly says something like this. She talks a lot about the expectations to really want to speak Korean and to really to learn it perfectly. We talked a lot about making Koreans disappointed in their language use throughout the data. So this is one sort of starting point. We wanted to see how they responded to these expectations, and here's where we get into the shifts between the storytelling world and the story world. And we wanted to see if the women expressed a desire to kind of align themselves with the Korean spaces for belonging that were given to them. And we wanted to see if they had desire to pass as Korean, desire to integrate, desire to be socially included in that manner. So Kelly tells a story, which is told by every woman in our data set, about taxi drivers, and how taxi drivers get angry at them for not being able to speak Korean fluently or good enough. And she recounts kind of an early period in her Korean life, her returning life, talking about a cab driver who became furious at her. And in the purple, it moves into the comment on this recounted past event. So this is the storytelling world where she is moving into the evaluative stance, the evaluative language here. I remember thinking, geez, you know, why are Koreans like this? Why is it that I come back to this country and I'm trying to make an effort to live here and learn the language and all I get is you're not good enough and it's not good enough, like blaming me because I don't speak the language and because I'm not Korean enough, when in fact I felt like all along that there was something wrong with Korean society for sending so many children abroad in the first place. So here we see she's creating quite a lot of resistance actually to the Korean space for belonging that's afforded to her, these expectations that are sent her direction. And she, in many places, talked about resisting that by not learning Korean. So it's a very interesting reaction for language learning that way. We also see from Anne an alignment with her very second language, but she describes it as broken Korean, rather than with this perfect, proficient, fluent, native-like Korean. She says, so I want Korean people to hear the broken Korean that comes out of my mouth, because I don't want them to have some fantasy that it was so wonderful and good to separate them from their families, talking about adoption in general, and send them to a place where, for instance, my sister was 4.5 years old at the time of adoption and she could not speak to anybody. For like 6 to 9 months, she didn't have a single word. I think that's like cruel and tragic, right? So really evaluating these past events in rather negative ways, in ways that resist and reject Korean expectations of adoption as sort of saving these children from a terrible life. This example is from Kim, and I'll have her step in, but it's kind of a counterexample. And this is the kind of space that we see the Korean adoptive attorneys are really looking for. It's an alternative space, so sort of like the previous presenter was talking about, this third space, alternative zone for belonging. And it's really about being recognized as an overseas Korean who happens to live in Korea. It's about being recognized as part of the spectrum of Korean people. And as Kim says, it's rare, right? It's a very rare experience. She's talking about getting her shoes shined, and she marks herself with English by talking on her cell phone in English, carrying an English newspaper. It's very much marked as a foreigner, you could say, or an overseas Korean. Korean. And the way she's responded to by a Korean national is, oh, you must be an overseas Korean. And we see in the evaluative language, this coming back into the storytelling world, I was amazed. And I was like, wow, she was nice. She didn't look at me like I was a freak. Right? So this reminds us of the evaluative language in the previous excerpts, where there's this positioning of resistance, rejection, negative sentiments, right? And she repeats it, oh, you must be an overseas Korean. And it's a very soft and sweet voice. And she talks, again, repeats this, wow, that's very nice, and also identifies that as being treated normally. So it's this very positive affiliation with this kind of space. So the question is, if this kind of example is rare, and if the participants are not really aligning or affiliating with the spaces afforded to them by Koreans, where do they go? How do they manage their life in Korea as adopted returnees? And a lot of them narrate a lack of finding ability to belong in mainstream societies. This is very similar to the previous paper as well. And what they do is they find a space to belong with one, atypical Koreans. So one of the participants, Lori, has a Korean national boyfriend. And she talks about how he's very unusual. And she narrates a typical experience with him. He'll just be walking down the street and he'll just jump on a concrete block and then leap off of it as if there's nobody around him. You know what I mean? Most people do not do that. Right? So he stands out, he's sort of unusual, atypical. And then she describes him as cute like that. And obviously he's her boyfriend, so she evaluates him quite positively. Kelly also talks about the people who she's able to connect with and who she feels comfortable using Korean with. And it's not the taxi cab drivers, it's not the mainstream Koreans. It's people who she describes as outside the normal segment of society, kind of on the fringe. She's the filmmaker, she has connections with artists. These are the people who she identifies with who have had kind of an unusual life for the typical Korean. The other main space for belonging is within the KAD community itself. And this is the central site for finding a sense of belonging. And what we found, sort of our conclusion in a way, is that these women are not finding their Korean identity in Korea. What they're doing is finding their KAD identity in Korea. This is really sort of a third space in many ways, but it's sort of a pluralistic conceptualization of being Korean as well. So Kelly talks about how she doesn't consider herself a part of Korean society, and she doesn't want to assimilate. She has this resistance to integration into what she calls mainstream Korean society. And she says, I belong here in my own way, which is sometimes, I think, a bit sheltered in the adopted foreign community, but why chase something I'm not? So she recognizes that other people might see her as not sort of an imposter. But she's very comfortable in that space. And there's a very poignant excerpt from Anne, who takes the opportunity to use the space given to her by Koreans, which is to call her not good enough, right? To question her identity, to treat her as Japanese because her Korean sounds funny, right? But she has an Asian face, so she can't be Korean. So she responds to all of these things by really enacting her KAD self. And she wants people to hear her broken Korean, to hear the damage that was done to her. And she also wants to talk about adoption. She says, it's like a little bit of a chance for me to proselytize about adoption. That's how she responds now when people say, you're not Korean, are you? I can tell you're not Korean. So this is quite a preliminary sort of look at this population. We're starting with interviews, but we hope to extend this to looking at actual language use in the KAD community. All of these women are relatively artistic in various ways, and there are very interesting ways that they use language. They use their heritage language in their English, speaking to each other. So this is something that we want to look at. And also in their artwork, in their spiritual thinking in their writing to extend it to that kind of domain. So I think we need to end there.
Thank you, Kim and Christina.